it please the court, Micah Eccles for the appellants. This is an appeal from a summary judgment order on the trustees' preference claims. And in this appeal, we've raised three issues. And as kind of alternative relief, we have another legal argument that we threw in there, which was not really a legal argument, but the NREF 5 certified question issue or the abeyance, since some of these issues are already pending in the Nevada Supreme Court. But in this appeal, the threshold issue we have is a bankruptcy court's lack of authority. And this goes to the Stern claim that we talked about. And the language that we quoted from Stern, which relies upon Langenkamp, fits into the facts of this case. It says a preferential...
Counsel, let me stop you. What you're suggesting is, if we accept your argument, is that the bankruptcy court wasn't empowered to enter a final judgment, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
But your brief says, in particular, page 9, that because you didn't file an answer, that Obiak and Snowshoe did not consent to jurisdiction, and then absent consent, the bankruptcy court can only enter proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law, which the district court reviews de novo, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
So from that argument, then, and from 28 U.S.C. section 157 C1, which is what gives the district court the authority to review the non-core matter once the bankruptcy court enters its findings of fact, the appeal then has to go to the district court if you want to have the findings of fact reviewed de novo, correct? Because that's what 158 C1 requires, is that you make an election, and you elected in this case to bring the case to the bankruptcy appellate panel, not to go to the district court, right?
Your Honor, what our argument is two parts, in that we have to have both conditions met, both the claim being filed and the answer. And the circumstances of this case are a little bit strange because...
What I'm getting at, counsel, that you're not addressing is, here we are in the BAP. You're suggesting that we should review the bankruptcy court's decision, which you characterize, because it's a Stern claim, as proposed findings of fact, conclusions of law. We don't have jurisdiction, do we, to review under those circumstances. Only the district court, by virtue of 28 U.S.C. 157C, has the ability to review that decision and make that determination. So why are you here?
Your Honor, we are here because we had the opportunity to elect either the bankruptcy appellate panel or the district court. And I don't recall in the answering brief raising this issue, but what I would ask, if the court believes that it does not have jurisdiction, if it's possible to transfer this case to the district court.
No, what we do is dismiss the appeal if your argument is correct, because if we don't have jurisdiction because you picked the wrong forum for us to decide this, then that would be our only option. We would be without jurisdiction. And then the question is, why wouldn't we sanction you for having put us and appellant's counsel, appellee's counsel, through the process of preparing an argument, filing a brief, and attending a hearing that you should have known. You had no jurisdiction. We have no jurisdiction over the determination because you raise an issue that you suggest we haven't got the ability to review.
Your Honor, I appreciate the question and the comments that you've made. And because these were not fleshed out in the answering brief, I would like the opportunity, if the court is considering sanctions, to file a supplemental brief addressing the court's concerns.
Of course.
Well, I'm not at the sanctions point. I'm sorry, Judge Taylor. I didn't mean to interrupt. Yeah. What I want to know is, you didn't raise this in your motion to dismiss that was filed, either the original motion to dismiss nor in your amended motion to dismiss. The local rule requires, on the first responsive pleading, motion, or paper that's filed in an adversary proceeding under 7012B, that you raise the issue. So you didn't. You didn't seek to withdraw the reference to see if the district court would decide this question under, because you raised it as a Stern suggestion in your motion for summary judgment. That's the first time you've raised it. Then you raise it with us and you don't elect the district court. Instead, you elect to come to the BAP, which is your choice because the statute provides you with the ability to make that decision upon your filing a notice of appeal. So why shouldn't we, in this instance, find that you've waived it, that you forfeited your right to raise the CERN question by failing to raise it below it timely? Number two, not taking and making the election to go to the district court and asking us to resolve this question now.
Your Honor,
I'm sorry. Judge Taylor has something else.
No, I just said that's a different question. Put the sanctions piece over here because we would give you an opportunity to be heard. But there's two possible ways we have waiver here. Why shouldn't we find that the Stern part of your argument has been waived either below or by your election here?
Your Honor, if the court looks at this in both the instance that Judge Gann talks about, as well as, and actually Judge Gann mentioned both of them, if this is a waiver, this is really our threshold issue in the case. And so if we don't win on the threshold issue, then we just go to the next argument. And that's why we've presented the three different arguments. Okay. And so if the court's looking at this as waiver, I can appreciate that and I can accept that. And that's why that wasn't our only argument.
All right.
So the second argument we have is the adoption by the district court of the state district court's findings of fact, conclusions of law with respect to the overlapping facts that are in this case. The issue we have with this is that first is an issue that's actually before the Nevada Supreme Court right now on whether the trustee had the ability to step into the shoes of a creditor in ongoing litigation that was already in Washoe County. And so really that's an issue that we've asked for either abeyance or NRAP 5 certification to the Nevada Supreme Court, because ultimately the Nevada Supreme Court has the ability to address the jurisdiction of its own courts.
But let me ask you to clarify that.
Okay.
So is the issue the question of whether the trustee could step into the litigation on behalf of the bankruptcy estate? That you're asking the state Supreme Court to determine that the trustee couldn't take over the litigation and become the plaintiff in that instance?
Basically the issue, Your Honor, is that the trustee could not come into the case on behalf of the creditors, not on behalf of the estate. And so that's the distinction that we're currently litigating in Nevada.
When you say the creditors, you mean the Herbst parties? It couldn't substitute in on behalf of the estate instead of just representing them individually?
Correct.
Is the issue?
Correct, Your Honor.
But it's true, isn't it, that in this instance, trustee filed a motion to substitute in. Your clients didn't oppose the motion and, in fact, stipulated that the trustee could substitute in. Then the substituted trustee filed an amended complaint that alleged that the fraudulent transfers were for the benefit of the bankruptcy estate, not for the Herbst party. And you didn't object or raise standing at any point during any of those proceedings.
The way that we've presented the argument in the Nevada Supreme Court, and we've reiterated some of the authorities in our briefs in this court, is under Swan v. Swan is a Nevada Supreme Court case that standing is a matter of subject matter jurisdiction and cannot be waived. And so even though there was a stipulation, as the court points out, subject matter jurisdiction cannot be waived. And so that's part of our argument there. There never was a specific finding that the trustee appeared on behalf of the estate, but there are some findings within the order, the final order from the state district court that say that it was for the benefit of the creditors. And so that's where we got that argument, Your Honor. So the next argument we have on preclusion, and this comes from I think it's finding number 26 on page 10 of the record. And the bankruptcy judge basically takes the state court's findings of fact and says, hey, I'm just going to adopt these as my own. And we provided some citations in the reply brief where we've quoted the record where he says, I could talk about all these other things, but I'm just going to adopt this wholesale. And so the way we've characterized this in our opening brief is we said the bankruptcy judge could not use preclusion as a sword, but rather under Nevada law, it can only be used as a shield. And the case that was talked about at the bankruptcy court level was Edwards versus Gandauer. Edwards basically involved a situation, plaintiff files against defendant in case one, appeals that, loses case one, plaintiff loses case one, appeals that, and then files case two. So plaintiff is the same in both cases. And the Supreme Court says, well, we're going to apply normal issue preclusion here. You've already litigated this issue. And the fact that your case is on appeal doesn't prevent us from applying preclusion principles. This case is different because instead of defensive issue preclusion, we have offensive issue preclusion, where the plaintiff is the same in both cases. It's the trustee. Wins in front of the state district court, and then in the bankruptcy court says, hey, to the bankruptcy court, now I want the bankruptcy court to just adopt everything as truth without having to independently demonstrate its position to the bankruptcy judge.
I asked for a little clarification because I'm confused by what you mean as offensive issue preclusion, because the parties are the same. And is the difference between the case that you cited and the present case that the plaintiff lost in one and won in the other? I'm not really getting why it's offensive issue preclusion.
Well, it's, Your Honor, it's because the trustee wants to take the findings that it obtained in the state court and then just have the bankruptcy court adopt those wholesale.
But that occurs in dischargeability litigation all the time.
Right.
I mean, that's the problem with offensive use is that the collateral estoppel seeks to foreclose a defendant from litigating an issue he has previously litigated unsuccessfully with another party. In this instance, and that's the point Judge Brand was just making, is that in this instance, yeah, you're right. It's offensive, but it's offensive because it's offending your client's position. The reality is it's the same two parties under a different theory, but using the same facts that were clearly established, at least according to the trustee's position, that were established by the state court against the same individual who had every right to defend. Biak was present. Snowshoe was a defendant. Snowshoe was in privity with Biak and the Biak Trust. I mean, nothing's different except you don't want to race judicata to apply, or you don't want collateral estoppel or issue preclusion to be applied here. Right.
Correct, Your Honor. And one of the other arguments we raise is, although there was a mention of claim preclusion, there wasn't actually an analysis of the Weddle v. Sharp factors under Nevada state law. And I'll reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
This is one of those where you probably should reserve what you've got left. We'll maybe add a few seconds back in and give them a flat 2 minutes when
you
come back.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. DeBerry. And you're muted. You're still,
it's still muted, unfortunately. There you are. Now you're good.
Thank you. And I swore to myself I would not make that error, and of course I did. May it please the court, counsel, Jonathan DeBerry of Sullivan Hill, resident Ingle, on behalf of Mr. William Leonard, the Chapter 7 trustee. Candidly, Your Honors have made many of the arguments I was going to make. Your Honor, Judge Gant has raised the issue of waiver, and that has jogged my memory. I believe it's the Eastern District, but I know one of the California districts actually does have a local rule suggesting that when you have a jurisdictional argument, going to the bankruptcy appellate panel as opposed to the district court is a waiver of that argument. And I would suggest that their time to make that appeal has now run since the time in which they had to appeal the bankruptcy court's decision is passed. I'm not sure.
I mean, I think our we're obviously troubled by this, but is it a waive? What is the quality of the waiver? I mean, does it mean that it's retroactively waiving, or you know, to the extent it wasn't waived below, it now is? Or is it simply a waiver in the sense that we can decide something, but if we but we can still decide there was no jurisdiction below to, or no power, excuse me, below to do it, so we send it back? And, you know, what does that mean? What does waiver mean in that context?
Well, first of all, I would mention that obviously this court, like all federal courts, first must determine which is why it's so important that Judge Gann raised that issue in the first instance. If they have I would suggest that they forfeit the right to appeal. If you file an appeal to the wrong court, this is venue matter where the district court says, well, I'm going to dismiss, but because the statute might have run, I'll instead change venue or require you to waive the statute of limitations. Here, their ability to appeal to a court which can give them appropriate relief has expired. And this court not grant appropriate relief, all it can do is affirm what happened below, what happened below. But this court actually, again, does not have the jurisdiction to do either. Therefore, they have forfeited that right. And that part of their case, I will say, I'm not sure that you can dice jurisdiction that finely, that they can still proceed with the other two arguments. If this court lacks jurisdiction to either affirm or reverse, that would also be true of the other issues that they have raised. But moving on to those other issues.
So, counsel, let me just ask you, based upon Mr. Eccles, or if I mispronounced his name, I apologize, indicated in response to my very convoluted but complicated question, it seemed to me he was suggesting we don't want to lose jurisdiction in the BAP. We want you to review the decision. We'll go from there. So it sounded to me like if waiver was necessary, he was agreeing that they waived the Stern argument. Did you hear something different? Am I misinterpreting what he said?
I think they have conceded that they have waived it, but I thought it appropriate to address the issue in case your honors didn't feel the same way. It is not correct to say that the trustees stepped into the shoes of the Herbst parties. This was not an assignment of a claim to the trustee. The trustee, as your honor indicated, was stipulated into the case. He then filed an amended complaint seeking different relief. He did not pursue on behalf of the Herbst parties, and that's how this is different from the Williams case that they cite, where the trustee basically acted as the attorney or the avatar, I think is what we would call him today, of a creditor or a group of creditors who were going to be the sole beneficiaries of that recovery. Here, the creditors of the estate will be the beneficiaries of the recovery. The statement that this is currently before the Nevada State Court, I think sort of begs the issue of, does the Nevada State Court have the right, and I would suggest it does not, to determine the powers of a bankruptcy trustee? That is reserved for the bankruptcy courts and the bankruptcy system. In fact, I would take their argument, Grunt's case, which is the decision that state courts cannot determine relief from stay matters, certainly not in a binding way, where the bankruptcy court has to abide by the determination of a state court. Whether the trustee has the ability, the right, under the bankruptcy code to pursue those claims is a matter reserved for the jurisdiction of this court. They talk about the use of issue preclusion. Your honors have mentioned the difference between it being parties who are in privity with each other. I would also point out that there is the Ninth Circuit law that we cited, In re Dites, I believe it is, and it's cited in our brief, that specifically affirms the use of offensive issue preclusion. That's a Ninth Circuit decision. That case came after the Waddell case that they are citing. So the Ninth Circuit's declaration of what Nevada law is, I submit, binding upon this court, because the Ninth Circuit certainly has not reversed its decision in Dites or even questioned it. So, I'm sorry, in Pike, it is the Dites case that says once we decide an issue, it's decided. And in Pike, they decided, yes, offensive issue preclusion is permitted under state law. With respect to whether Judge the bankruptcy court did the Waddell analysis, it presumed that he knew the law and knew the requirements. He was very familiar with the record, as you can tell from reading the case. We would submit that given his comments over the length of the hearing, he did the Waddell analysis, although perhaps he did not have a checklist before him and say, I'm going to find issue one, I'm going to find issue two, et cetera.
Is he required to do that, though? I mean,
he is not. If you read the Waddell case, they say how the court is to address that. And even if it did, I would suggest that may not be binding on a bankruptcy court because that might be a procedural issue as opposed to a substantive law of, well, this is what you have to find. That would be substantive. How you find it and how you articulate it would be a procedural issue. First of all, he did it. It's very clear. And as we also mentioned, it is so clear from the record, it would be harmless error. I don't think we are asking the court to make appellate factual findings. We are asking the court to say that having reviewed the entire record, we can find that Judge Zive knew what the requirements of Waddell were, and he met those requirements in his analysis, even if he did not use a checklist.
Counsel, let me just ask, I'm also a little concerned that Waddell may not be applicable in this instance, and that is because it generally is used when a defendant in a prior suit is able, when a defendant is able to say that the plaintiff didn't include them in a prior suit for a reason that was unfair and now is seeking to use collateral estoppel of issue preclusion against them. And we know that in this case, Bayek and the Bayek Trust and Snowshoe were all parties to the prior litigation. So is that another basis to distinguish Waddell from this particular matter?
Certainly, I'm going to agree with Your Honor, yes. And I didn't go into depth because Your Honor articulated that before I reached that issue. But certainly, yes, okay. We agree with that.
Okay. So on one hand, you think it's not applicable. On the other hand, you think that the record would demonstrate that if it was necessary, he complied.
Yeah. And the one thing I would add, it comes to mind, is I believe they have forfeited that issue because it was not raised in the bankruptcy court. And so that's a forfeiture. Unless the panel has questions, that's my argument.
All right. Judge Gann?
I didn't have anything else I really needed to address with counsel.
I'm fine, thanks.
All right, thank you. All right, Mr. Eccles, you're going to benefit from his argument going a little bit short, and we'll give you, you've got about a minute, we'll give you two.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. So to answer Judge Gann's question that came up in the answering argument, on the threshold issue of jurisdiction, Your Honor was questioning whether we would waive the the threshold issue on the Stern and so forth. Absolutely, we will, because we'd rather have the court decide the other issues in the case rather than dismiss the appeal. On the preclusion issue, Judge Gann, again, Your Honor raises an interesting issue of does Waddell apply? Or does some other version of claim preclusion apply? And in Nevada State Court, it kind of started with Edwards versus Gandauer. I'm sure it goes before that. Then went to Five Star versus Ruby, and then went to Waddell. And then there's a more recent case that doesn't add a whole lot to Waddell, but it does add some things that was cited in our brief called Mendenhall versus Tassinari. And so really Waddell added was that third factor that Your Honor mentioned. Even if Waddell didn't apply, the district court or the bankruptcy court would still be required to fall back to the earlier version of the, which would go back to the Five Star case. And then I think everything else we've kind of addressed, but
Well, let me just ask you about the last thing that he suggested, which was waiver. Do you think you raised the issue with regard to the obligation of the court to set forth the factors of why issue preclusion does or doesn't apply in your original opposition to summary judgment?
I don't know if it was in there, Your Honor. But the reason I raise it is because it showed up on page 10 of the record, where it states preclusion principles but has no further analysis. There was no analysis at the time of the hearing, and so that's the reason I've raised it at this point.
You couldn't have raised it below because you didn't know what he was going to do.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
All right. I don't have anything else unless the court has questions for me.
Judge Gann?
No, I'm fine.
Rand?
No, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much for your arguments, and this will be deemed submitted.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Your Honors.